Friday, December 14th. Welcome to a very special holiday episode. Just kidding. It's not. It's just the same.
Same as all the
it's
others.
It's a little
Nothing
special.
We should do that.
Ever changes.
I personally really would like it if something changed.
I was reflecting upon a year ago when I was putting on fancy outfits and going to holiday parties.
Your gala lifestyle that you had.
Yeah.
Well, let's start then with something nice for once, and we'll get into the pandemic and all other kinds of awful things happening around the city. But let's start with some nice stuff. Alyssa, you were saying that you had we can do LA stories with like ways that we have like found fulfillment during the pandemic, like something nice.
I'm trying to think about like what is at the top of like, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. What have I done that qualifies as fulfilling during COVID? I don't know if I told you, Hayes, Sarah and I went out to El Matador in Malibu a while ago. And that was the furthest that I had gone from my house. First of all, going to Malibu takes forever.
Yeah.
That was the furthest. Actually, will probably until the end of COVID remain the furthest that I go from my house. It was something like 30 miles or whatever. But just like being there, being able to see signs that other people still exist is kind of nice, a nice reminder. And that was immediately before all of the post-Thanksgiving stay-at-home orders went into effect. I don't know. It was a very, I guess, a very brief reprieve where something felt normal, just like having a little breakfast. We just had tacos at the beach and got harassed by some seagulls. It felt like a very nature is healing kind of moment. But then, of course, that ended up not being true, as evidenced by everything that followed.
Going and looking at the ocean, I've done it a couple times, something I would never do pre-pandemic, just drive like a total of 3 hours just to look at the water for a little bit. But yeah, that has been nice for me too for some reason. And I discovered, I think, a lot of shooting locations from the Rockford Files, which I also watched a few episodes of during this time. So that's been exciting too. Alyssa, what is it for you?
Well, this time of year is good for an activity that's already kind of naturally socially distant, which is driving around and looking at Christmas lights, which, of course, I would say a better way to do it would be on a bus or on a bike. But when you have two small children and it's almost their bedtime and one of them actually falls asleep in the car as you're going to look at the lights, I would think the car is a good tool. And we went to Christmas Tree Lane in Altadena. Have you been?
No.
Hayes has one of these trees in his yard, so he doesn't even have to go anywhere to experience the grand, the
you
grandness.
You got a big tree, Hayes?
Yeah, I have one huge tree that we should figure out. I mean, actually, no. It would be like a huge ordeal to decorate it. But so on Christmas Tree Lane, they have a lot of trees all lit up.
A deodar cedar.
Yeah.
And they're from the Himalayas originally. And this is like the typical, like, I feel like every street in Altadena probably has like one rich person who moved here from the Midwest who decided some particular tree needed to be planted like 50 times. So they're majestic and gorgeous like all year round, but during the Christmas season. And since like the dawn of electricity, like this is like quite an amazing tradition. They have now, they're now up to 10,000 lights that they string on it. And there's so many lights that like the city has to come like do it and literally install like breaker boxes on all the trees. So you're like driving down and you see this like infrastructure. You can't really see it because it's dark. But we went and got there right when the lights turn on at 6 o'clock.
Cool.
I just thought they were on all the time, but then I was like, oh, let me read the fine print. And you're kind of sitting there and it is this kind of magical, as close as you can get to a very magical Southern California holiday moment. And then you can drive up and down the street and some people walk, but there's no sidewalks. It's a bit, you know how it is.
Yeah.
And so some people did walk, but it did say like they wanted people to be in their cars. I guess like normally they have like vendors selling hot chocolate or something, like it's more festive, right. But still really fun. And everybody had their windows down, so you could still feel like you were around a bunch of other people that were hopefully far enough away from you.
Car protest.
Yeah.
Except slightly except we're protesting. More seasonal.
Yeah. Except, yeah. And no chance of snow, I think, for our mountains for the whole month. So this might be as good as it's going to get if you want to have some festive cheer for yourself.
Well, it's dry as fuck. It's really dry.
We haven't talked about
this. Actual forecast. You're right. Yeah, that's what they said. Extended outlook.
And it's making me remember the Christmas from, was it 2 years ago now, where it was the fire Christmas where we had a really bad.
Was that only 2 years ago?
The Thomas fire burned all winter long, when you remember.
Yes.
So we had, it would never stop.
Yeah, I think you're right, Hayes.
Yeah.
2018, right?
2018 was Woolsey, and 2017, I think, was Thomas, right? Or 2016? Right. Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, just looking at my weather app, it's sunny days for like the rest of the month of December. We're not going to get a drop of rain. And it doesn't look great for the next couple months. The thing I've been doing, I haven't had anything that's like taking me out into the city in any significant way for the past month. So I've decided when I go for a run, I have been driving to a run. Don't get mad at me. But I just pick a different neighborhood every week, and I spend the week running around that neighborhood.
That's nice.
Last week was Highland Park. I've been doing historic Filipino town this week. And, you know, like it gives you like a ground level feeling of an area that I hadn't had previously really in either of those. I spend time in them, but not on that consistent a basis. And it's just, you know, you get a little vibe check in every one of the different like parts of the city.
Totally.
I kind of just started doing this, but I do recommend it.
Go outside, listeners, and you might see Hayes running around your neighborhood. That's actually very nice. I feel like you double dipped a little bit since you already said that you were going to the ocean a lot.
I don't do that a lot, and that was yours. I was really just affirming what you said. But if you prefer me to just be silent when you tell your story,
I've not gone to the ocean, like not at all.
Not once?
Not during this whole time. Because I don't know. I've just always worried too much about crowds and like my kids being.
There's not that many people.
Strange
out there.
Environment.
Really not.
But some. Always some families without masks.
And we were out there we were out there very early in Malibu. There was basically no one there, which was nice. I did kind of feel like I was doing the end of Barton Fink, where I was just like, where he's just like at the end of his rope and has no other option but to just stare at the water. I felt a little bit more. I felt closer to that movie afterward. That was kind of our cold open. We are an LA podcast. So.
Now we get into down to business. Hospitalizations, cases, deaths, the normal content of the last few weeks. I was thinking about last week we were saying at the end of the episode, like, wow, what are we going to be talking about? Like, what situation are we going to be in a week from today when we do our next episode? And it's so remarkable how the situation is decisively, objectively more severe than it was a week ago, but it doesn't necessarily feel that way. So today we had 12,700 new cases announced, staggeringly huge number, which if last week you had told us a week from today you're going to have 12,700 cases, we'd be like, wow, that is so many more. We just had 10,000 announced, and that's a record. That's a huge number. But in the intervening days, 12,700, we've had higher case numbers than that twice already. Like the numbers are just so much bigger than they were a week ago, including hospitalizations. We went from 3,000 people in the hospital with COVID in LA County to today, it's around 4,200. That increase in the space of a week is totally unprecedented. And we're still at an almost vertical curve compared to earlier in the pandemic in terms of people getting hospitalized.
It's, I mean, the thing that I think is most worrisome, according to medical professionals is really the ICU capacity, which we've seen continue to just not steadily, but it has been decreasing for over a month at this point. ICU hospital beds available has just been going down and down and down. That is in particular such a concern because the ICU is where people with COVID, people who have the types of pneumonia that we know that people get from this virus, they get the ventilator care that they need. They get the around-the-clock attention that they need from doctors with a high degree of specialization and training. So we looked at ICU beds available just from the data that the state publishes, and it's extremely worrisome to me just as a member of the public looking at this and seeing, in terms of rough math, it looks like we are very close to running out of ICU beds at the rate that we're going. Potentially, I said somewhere between 10 days and 2 weeks from now. Basically, Hayes pointed out that that's probably at the maximum amount of time that we have left, because things are still accelerating. Like you said, this, we're still on this vertical upswing, and we can see that the capacity is being filled at a faster rate every day as it goes.
Yeah, we have, as of the current numbers on Sunday, are 392 ICU beds available. That is a loss of 52 beds from just yesterday. And, you know, in terms of other hospitalization numbers, the increase in new admissions gets worse every day. So that number could go down really fast. At the same time, the one bright spot is it appears that ICU beds have been scaled up over the course of this pandemic. So at the very beginning, on March 29th, there were only 191 people in the hospital with COVID, but we only had 345 available ICU beds at that point. So now we have 4,000 people in the hospital, and we have more ICU beds available still.
Yep.
Things are getting worse so quickly that we're still in a really precarious position, but the number of beds appears to have gone up by a lot. That ICU number just doesn't change as quickly. But in terms of capacity, we don't have any new rules to announce this week for the first time in a while, except playgrounds are open. They undid that, right?
Yeah, they did.
At the state level.
Alyssa?
Yeah.
At the state level, yeah.
Oh, right. So does that mean you still can't do that?
Well, yeah, I guess we could have, LA County could have said we're going to keep ours closed, but they did, in fact, open theirs at the next day. So the state said statewide, as part of their stay at home, they could reopen them. And I do think that has to do with, there was a very wonderfully written letter by Scott Morrow, who's the health officer in San Mateo County, that was just like, I'm going to be straight with you guys, and I'm going to tell you that these things don't make sense to me. Like, we have people playing sports, we have people shopping, you know, he was like very real. And one of their recommendations was actually to keep playgrounds open for that very reason, just as like parents don't have anywhere else to go. And like, we think the risk is very small. Yep. And I have a feeling it changed like 2 days later. And I have a feeling that that had some influence, because that was widely shared and people were kind of throwing that in the face of their own local health officer and being like, if this guy says this.
Yeah.
So
I really appreciated that letter. It was very thoughtful from Scott Morrow. It was very, I think, grounded in the language that he was using, you know, saying, you know, please don't take this message out of context, and like, you know, do what you can to stay home and listen to public health orders. But talking,
I'm sure nobody did. Thankfully, I'm sure
so many people were sharing it. So many people were sharing it, like, see, like, we should be open. And there's literally the line in there says exactly that. Do not take this that way.
And yet, you know, like, I don't blame him for that. I feel like handled in as responsibly a way as possible when you have limited control over how people decontextualize your remarks. But I did feel like there was a lot of discussion of the same things that we have said on this program from a position of course, more authority and experience. And in particular, when it came to like a public health officer saying, I don't understand like how these regions are structured or what it is intended to mean if like capacity is running out in one county but is not somewhere else, like what are we sending an intelligible message to the public? I felt like that concern was really well founded and is one that we've expressed numerous times on here.
But in terms of capacity, so roughly a week ago, the number that triggered the stay at home order was 15% ICU capacity in our huge weird region of Southern California. That went into place about a week ago, and as of today, that number is at 5% for the Southern California region. In the San Joaquin Valley, they're at 0. It's kind of wide ranging and in different parts of California, but I think at the Southern California region is the second most dire number. We want to talk about one hospital in LA County where there has been a lot of activity, a lot of people running around in scrubs, big like trucks and like trailers outside, signs saying like triage in this direction. What's going on at St. Vincent's Medical Center, Alyssa?
Well, this was spotted by Twitter user Blue Shell Party. I don't know if that's the actual address of the...
I think it is.
Okay. So this was spotted by Twitter user Blue Shell Party. St. Vincent's, as you remember, was the hospital. I think it has like 300 beds or so. It's in Westlake on 3rd, and it was closed recently, and then it was going to be used as homeless housing, but then there was a sale. We'll talk about that in a minute. So it no longer is something that we can officially use as our response. But of course, since filming is deemed essential, we have a pilot being shot there right now, and it's called Triage. Mm-hmm. And there are people, simulating.
What could be more essential than filming a pilot, Alyssa?
There are people.
Name one thing more essential than filming a pilot for a medical
a pilot about. They're probably doing like an episode right now about like a pandemic, and they're actually like going through it. So this brings up two. Well, okay, so who owns it? First of all, let's talk about that. I feel like Hayes is the expert here. We should almost do like one of your place segments on this.
I know, right?
Sometime.
Because this is a really fascinating location, but I don't think we really have time this week. So this property was, the hospital went bankrupt, basically, and it was sold to Patrick Soon-Shiong, a part owner of the Lakers, owner of a lot of patents for cancer treatments, and owner of the LA Times, which notably has not written about the fact that this hospital is being used as a filming location when we are about to run out of hospital space in Los Angeles, even after this facility was briefly used as what doctors who are working there described as a really successful experiment in offering emergency care for free to people who needed it. Now that is no longer available, and people are filming stuff in there. Triage stars Michael Ealy, who is very handsome, and I don't blame for this. Like, I don't think he's like guys.
Someone
any reason
get to him though? Just tell him. I mean, I think maybe that's just what they're doing. They're just, you know, testing, getting emergency care to people, but just using actors as the doctors.
It's Argo. It's the cover.
But
they shut down this facility really fast, though. Like
shut it down fast because of lack of need at some point.
This was in April.
Yeah.
Right? This was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. But now it seems like the situation has changed, both from a pandemic perspective and honestly from a homelessness perspective, which it was always something that it really could have been
used a place for people to be isolating. The hotel situation, but this would have been a very easy, you have separate rooms. And then at the same time, we have Mitchell Farrell, who this is his district. He was the one who was supposed to turn it into housing, but then I really don't understand what happened. Like, just someone could come in and just buy something out from under you and just say, we're not going to do anything with it, which is kind of sounds like what happened. But he sent in his newsletter. First of all, he said the facility is empty, and I'm just wondering if he went by there, because it's very clear that it is not empty at this moment. But also kind of making it seem like he was trying to convince the new owners and that they weren't cooperating in some way. So kind of putting the blame on them for not turning this back into a pandemic resource.
the phrasing that Mitch O'Farrell used in the newsletter that he sent out this week about St. Vincent was, now empty and owned by Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, also the publisher of the Los Angeles Times, this facility must be reactivated to provide acute care to the people who are dying on our streets in growing numbers every day. I am leading an initiative with the city, county, and hopefully a willing Dr. Soon-Shiong to explore a partnership to provide medical and mental health services to our unhoused residents. So this doesn't sound like it's a thriving collaboration between the city and the second richest, or richest again now, because we lost our richest resident.
True. Doesn't Bezos live here?
Well, Bezos lives here now. It depends if you count his residency as a California
Bezos
residency.
Bezos, I guarantee you, does not claim residency in the state of California. So I don't know what the upshot of this is going to be, but we said this at the time. We talked about it on the show. The city was going to buy this facility. Yeah. Mitch O'Farrell was talking about what it was going to be used for. And then they were like, no, no, it's cool. We got this rich person to buy it instead, and he's going to lease it out to us for this service. But
it's actually like, been leased out to film studios.
To other services. Other
well, I mean, wasn't there a point in time, too, where he had been looking at using this for his medical nonprofit that he was going to start?
Well, it was something about the vaccine, right? It was related to the vaccine.
Yeah,
for
vaccine.
Some...
At one point, yes. Actually, we talked about this, too. Dr. Soon-Shiong had said that he hadn't really been able to deal with stuff going on at the larger reckoning going on at the LA Times because he was busy working on a COVID vaccine that the result of which we have not really heard too much about either. So
yeah, go ahead. I was just going to say, like, the amount of times that filming has been in the news in the past, not even that long, like what, 2 weeks?
Yeah,
now?
The last we've 2 weeks. Had,
yeah.
Or if you go back 3 weeks, then you also get the Union Station closing down for He's All That, yep. The She's All That gender swap remake, which closed a brief or would have closed a COVID testing site. Then there was, of course, the Bill Mulligan special in the Valley where they were doing craft services mm-hmm. after they had announced that outdoor dining couldn't take place. Now there's this. There's also another scene on Twitter that Ian Carr, a Twitter user at That Carr, posted video of filming and food distribution taking place immediately adjacent to a major homeless encampment in downtown Los Angeles. That's a lot of high profile stuff for film. Like, what is it about? I don't, what is it about filming that is just attracting all of this like a giant shit magnet right now?
This is the only source of revenue, one of the only sources for the city of LA that has actually, first of all, it's one of the only sources right. of a revenue period is these film permits. And it's the only one that has gone up significantly from previous years. With the drawdown of like so many other city activities, they are getting more production is happening here than has happened in the past. And so I think that's like one of the reasons you're seeing it everywhere is because right. it just is happening more often. And of course, wherever you film in LA, you're going to interact with right now closed businesses and people living on the street. And so I'm sure there are a lot of other examples that we just haven't been exposed to, that people haven't been there to,
sure.
to take pictures of. If Blue Shell Party hadn't shared us about St. Vincent's, I don't know if we would have ever would have ever found out.
But how come that's not a national news story? I mean, I this is where the Union Station testing was like covered by the New York Times and the Guardian.
And this is a hospital.
This is a hospital that they're filming a show called Triage. I mean,
it's pretty wild.
It could be because I don't understand. The main coverage entity in the city of LA is owned by the same person.
This is a question we hospital. Have for you.
I mean, I feel like that would just make it more enticing for the New York Times or the Washington Post right? to come in and be like, but I do. I think in general, it seems like, well, so there are definitely different camps here. There's the group of people who looks at film industry as whatever Hollywood liberal elites or something. Even within LA County, I'm assuming there is some small mm-hmm. group to that effect. and are looking at this as evidence of the Democratic politicians privileging some businesses over others. But I think that there's a larger group of people that's not even, that's basically looking at this as, why is the city not trying to take care of the people who desperately need to be taken care of? And we see that both in terms of the hospital capacity, where it's like, we're using this for filming, which is not an emergency, when we have an emergency shortage in hospital space imminent in the city. And then secondarily, like, we have so many people who are unhoused on our streets. And again, there is a deference that seems to be shown to most businesses, and right, like, not towards people who are living unhoused on the streets. But it's important to remember that when we talk about ICU capacity in particular, which is really what the concern is when we're talking about running out of hospital space, the biggest issue actually is not about geometric space at all. It's
staffing.
Not like, it's really about staffing. It's, yeah, really about, do you have people who can operate the equipment? Mm-hmm. Do you have people who are trained to respond when somebody's oxygen levels start, or see the signs before it's too late?
Right.
So it's about keeping people alive. And really, there's not staff such that, and maybe this is the case for St. Vincent's, they're not really staff such,
right,
that we can dramatically increase the capacity of ICUs right now.
Well, look, at some point, it seems like, we will not have to talk about this stuff anymore, because starting tomorrow, the vaccines are getting rolled out and getting shot into people's arms in LA County. As frontline workers in the podcast industry, we have been informed that we are being pushed to the front of the line. We are medical workers in sort of a Patch Adams capacity, apparently. I didn't think that, like, our work was that valuable, but apparently
next, the cast of Triage will be second. Yes. So they can continue their essential work.
So tomorrow this vaccine is going out. I've heard different things at, like, the state level, at the county level. Everywhere is doing things a little bit differently. Apparently, LA County is not doing it like a lot of other places, where they're kind of waiting for CVS and Walgreens to be sort of the administrators of these vaccines to people who are eligible. They are training up people that work in care facilities and the places that are going to get the vaccine first to actually deliver them. So it's going to be about a week in advance of a lot of other places that they're getting injected here, which is cool.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I know that this is, when we talk about the vaccine, there's a lot of discussion right now going on nationally and internationally about how, as we scale up distribution, like, who is able to get it here in LA County, like you're saying, like many other places in the country, we are going to have our first line hospital medical workers receive the vaccine first. From there, I think they basically move on to groups that are most at risk of serious illness, including people with, you know, a wide array of medical conditions, mm-hmm, immunocompromised health systems, people who are, I believe, probably pregnant will be up towards the front of the line as well. And from there, I mean, so, like, when we talk about getting enough people inoculated against COVID to start actually bringing the pandemic to an end, have you guys heard, like, dates as far as when that might be on the horizon for us?
I've heard more concern, like, you know, you hear a lot of different people usually talk about it in terms of months, March, April, May, whatever. And then there's that's the first one. And then 3 weeks later, you get the booster shot, at which point,
yeah.
But I've heard more concern about vaccine resistance this week. Brittany Mejia in the LA Times wrote about how there are conversations in the Latino community about how the vaccine is, like, not to be trusted, and there's a fair amount of resistance to taking it, and including the people that have, like, lost family members. There's just, like, a lot of rumors going around that it's not safe or something like that. And Brittany Mejia actually saw her post that after she wrote that story, she talked to members of her own family who were saying that they were not going to get the vaccine. And this is one of the hardest hit communities in terms of cases and hospitalizations and deaths in Los Angeles County, which has the largest Latino population in the country by far. So it's out where I think now the focus rather on like scheduling when people get it is like really making sure that this campaign to ensure that people do get it is so much more successful than any of the ones previously related to this pandemic. Like now is the opportunity to undo some of the damage that has been wrought previously by a well-executed PR campaign around this vaccine, which shouldn't be that hard to do. Like they had, you know, so many, they brought out the celebrities to be like, wear a mask and do social distancing and stuff. Now is the time to watch them get the thing in their arm. That's a much more useful example, I think, than telling people to wear a mask coming from a celebrity.
The ex-presidents are doing that, right? They're getting
I'm not sure it was the most helpful. Here we are, the most trusted people in America who everyone loves.
I feel like that's the thing, is that when you're in an environment where there is widespread distrust of our health system, of our leadership, politically speaking, at a number of levels of government, I feel like it's so easy to imagine the part of your brain that attaches to conspiracies just being like, yeah, well, they're not getting the same thing that they're going to shoot in my arm, right? Like,
right.
It's very hard to combat that kind of distrust, which is why I think that this won't be as easy as you maybe think it will be, Hayes, because I feel like this is very similar to...
I don't think it'll be easy. I just think it will be... I mean, there's an opportunity there compared to try and get people to mask and like do social distancing when people have to go to work.
Right, sure.
Like, you know.
I just feel like what we're running up against as a society, I think pretty frequently these days, is that for such a long time, the groups with relatively more power in our society have been saying, we don't need to care about what black people do, what brown people do, what indigenous people do. We just don't, it's not important, who cares what they do. And now more often we're running into these changing circumstances where they're like, oh, well, actually we do need to care about what people as a whole are doing and the muscles that they could use to like to actually be persuasive and communicate with people and in these communities are atrophied or just like totally absent. And I feel like it's very similar to what happened with the census. Like you have Eric Garcetti basically going out on his hands and knees and begging people to like take the census or to fill out the census. But it's, you know, like that kind of communication when it just happens in a vacuum like that, there's not a connection between Garcetti and the communities that he was trying to reach out to. Mm-hmm. And I'm worried that that will be basically the same dynamic we'll see here.
And you know, we've talked about this in past weeks, all of this or none of this is going to have an effect on what happens through like Christmas and the end of the year. The number of cases that are showing up right now are going to just place an astonishing burden on our medical system. But the more people are vaccinated, even that first shot creates a little bit of resistance.
Yeah.
And so it will have some, like every single shot will have some effect. And there are tens of thousands going out really quickly. So the hope is that if they're prioritized correctly, if they're going to the people that are around the people who are most vulnerable and are out working in the world, that while we won't have a safe environment for a few months, we won't have the unchecked spread that we're seeing right now. Despite the efforts of a few individuals in the restaurant industry and the courts, which let's talk about right now. We talked last week about the Restaurant Association and one specific restaurant, Engine Company number 28 downtown, suing LA County. This big court case brought against the county for arbitrarily shutting down outdoor dining. Now, since this court case has been brought, you would think that like just the fact that that the cases and deaths and hospitalizations are so much worse than they were would make people say, like, you know what? Okay, yes, this is maybe not the time to, like, send people back into the world to, like, go out to eat. But no, this case is still happening. And one, the judge in charge of the case, James Chalfant, basically found that the Restaurant Association had standing in calling this the ban on outdoor dining arbitrary.
Right.
He found that there wasn't really sufficient evidence to show that outdoor dining was unsafe, or that the county hadn't proven that successfully. And yeah,
this was the big thing, right? Like, the county had to go to court and offer its evidence for the closures that it had made. And so Judge Chalfant basically said what they brought was insufficient.
And this is not really the first time he's weighed in on this kind of issue in this way. He really does not believe the government's messaging around coronavirus. And he said in his ruling that, like, healthy people, we need to acknowledge that, like, healthy people are not really at risk
right.
when it comes to this virus, which A, is not true.
So dangerous and incredible.
And B, does not acknowledge, just like, and not that anyone who's listening to this doesn't understand better than this judge does, but does not acknowledge, like, the basic realities of how a pandemic works, of how when you contract a virus, like, potentially you will be okay, but you will spread it to other people, one of whom likely will be put in the hospital.
I also, like, just want to just spend a moment, because he did say this about people who are, you know, people who are healthy, whatever, are not at risk. That really leaves a lot on the table. Like, when you imply that the only risk that should be taken into consideration is the risk of you personally dying from the disease, that leaves such a spectrum of outcomes unaddressed, basically. Like, mm-hmm. we know that there's a ton that we don't know about what happens to people yeah. who have COVID and survive. And a lot of the messaging from medical experts has been, do what it takes to not get this disease. You don't know if you right. will end up being one of the long COVID patients. You don't know if you will end up having a long-term disability as a result of having had COVID. That affects people across a variety of age ranges, pre-existing health conditions. As the mayor said in one of his COVID shows earlier this year, I think what he said was the likelihood of you having a significantly changed health outcome after recovering from COVID as a 30-year-old is greater than the likelihood that you die of COVID as a senior. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can get the disease and it can fundamentally change the rest of your life, as far as we can tell. Again, this is a disease that's been around for about a year now. So just incredibly right. irresponsible for this judge to make that claim that he did make.
As that, you know, the NBA is coming back and, like, young NBA players are still yep. not fully recovered from having had COVID. Keontae Johnson, college basketball player in Florida, collapsed on
yeah.
the court, potentially because of the long-term effects of COVID. Like, yeah, we don't even know the full ramifications of this stuff.
And it's interesting, too, that we were talking about and hearing this judge, like you said, talk about this, you know, there was no workers from these restaurants there to testify.
Yeah.
It was, you know, somebody who owns a restaurant basically yelling at, through the judge's mediation, you know, like, the yelling at the county and having this big, like, heated debate. And you're right that he, you know, really throwing out everything that we know about this virus and the science and the people at the county who have worked so hard to, like, share this information with, you know, these residents, but then also talk about the vaccine kind of being used as this excuse, like, oh, well, the vaccine's coming anyway. Why would we shut down? Let's just keep it going and then we can get to the vaccine. I mean, mm-hmm. we're going to start seeing this more as, like, a reason to keep things open because the vaccine is here. I think the news was, like, that day that, like, the emergency mm-hmm. approval had happened. You know, this was, like, on Tuesday. So you really, and then you saw later, I got the pleasure of watching the Beverly Hills City Council meeting that day to look at their plans to start their own health department, which is just a joy.
All the rage right
now. If you ever get a chance to just listen to the Beverly Hills City Council meeting, I highly, highly encourage it. Their Zoom game is better than any city council. I mean, these are mansions and like a mahogany paneled library.
Wow.
With like works of art. But, you know, they were saying the same thing, you know, kind of like we have this vaccine coming, like, let's just get this going. And this is what we're going to hear as like a justification for endangering people's lives, because the vaccine is here now. Let's just start this economy back up and get rip roaring back to it. And so the ruling was from the county that on December 16th, which is coming up, which was the original end of the 3-week period that the county put as part of their stay-at-home order until it was superseded by the state order, which ends actually after Christmas. But by December 16th, unless he changes this again, the county will have to come to them with evidence and say, you know, this is the demonstrated risk of outdoor dining. I don't know what they're going to say, because I think the hospital numbers speak for themselves at this point. I mean, I don't know what you would want them to say. And I hope they come back with some very spicy retort to this ruling.
Right. But
they're going to have to answer to this. And it's going to be twisted in all sorts of ways to be able to endanger the lives of workers and people who have no choice in this matter.
I want to read the judge's exact words before we move on. He said, "I think one of the problems with the pandemic is that government agencies, including the media, are driving the fear."
Guilty. Guilty as a state sponsored media.
United States Department of Curbed.
"And the evidence shows that healthy Americans need not fear. And I think that has been a tremendous failure by government agencies and spokespersons. The average healthy American is not seriously at risk of dying. There's no question the health department has a dilemma. The health department's job is to make sure the healthcare system is not overwhelmed, and they have to do something. The question is, what do you do? You have seized on a straw. Outdoor dining carries a minimal risk, according to the CDC, blah, blah, blah." I mean, it's just like, at what point do you lose your license to like practice? I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like just on its face. That idea would put so many people in danger if it were taken seriously, let alone legislated.
Very bad.
Yeah. And the long term impacts of this ruling, where he's basically saying that there needs to be an environmental impact review sort of process in order to implement any kind of public health ruling, which if you're unfamiliar with, those are the things that anybody who has like wants to build anything goes through. This process that can take years and years, at which point lots of people are dead if you're talking about public health. I mean, it's pretty unavoidable.
It's a big week at City Hall. We have, and also at the county level, we have the new electeds who were voted in and on November 3rd starting to actually get to work. We have two very new council members added to Kevin DeLeon, who got to start his work a little early in the 14th district, Mark Ridley Thomas and Nithya Raman. Nithya was sworn in this week on Thursday. It was a very tiny Zoom swearing in. I was lucky enough to get to go. It was so wonderful and moving. And their first meeting is on Tuesday, where, you know, it's part of the tradition that new incoming council members put forward a couple motions to kind of announce what some of their priorities are going to be. But at the same time, they're also jumping into a situation where we're actively discussing major layoffs at the city level, like ways to like save money and like where additional money to fill holes in the budget is going to come from. I've seen people saying that the budget deficit, the city administrative office is saying it's around $650 million, but others are saying $800 million. I've heard a billion is what it actually could be. All in all, I mean, it's a very fraught moment for these new council members to be showing up. It's also the day that the election for the new council president is going to not new council president, but Nuri Martinez, current president of the city council, that position is up for a vote again. I don't think anything eventful is going to happen there, as far as I can tell. She is just going to be reelected as council president. But what, like, I'm curious what you two think. Alyssa wrote a big article for Curbed about Nithya. Scott, you obviously have worked a lot with her campaign and know her office. Like, what is the job of a new council member showing up, just like being thrown into the deep end on this stuff?
Well, I think we've been able to see what the aquarium is like, or the swimming pool. I don't know. Is it sharks?
Thrown into the deep end of the aquarium. That is really actually.
I was like, is it sharks? Is it humans? Yeah. Like, what are we? Is it jellyfish? Kevin De Leon, I think, has, you know, he kind of came in a little bit earlier. He would have been sworn in this past week if it wasn't for some other issues. That's all I'm going to say. But I think he has really tried to make a splash. I didn't even mean to continue the analogy. But he has, I think, tried to differentiate himself in many ways. And you can really see him trying to carve out, like, his personal issues. And I do think some of those will be ones that at least Councilmember Rahman, I'm just going to start saying that instead of Nithya, does, I think, want to focus on too. So I think they'll have good momentum maybe starting into here.
But I haven't seen De Leon as out front on budget issues specifically. He's done a lot of he's put forward motions around homelessness. He's been active around getting the Caltrans properties in El Sereno potentially repurposed so they can be used by people experiencing homelessness. But like, do you just like show up and say, here's my plan for how to resolve the city budget? Or is that where you defer to the people that have been in office a little longer?
I really don't think we'll see Kevin De Leon and Mark Ridley Thomas do a lot of deferring. I mean, by nature of, I actually heard an interview with council member Ridley Thomas not too long ago on KPCC, where he was talking about the relatively different picture between Los Angeles County, where he just exited as a supervisor, and LA City, where he is once again now after the 1990s again a council member, and he mentioned that, you know, the county of Los Angeles is extremely healthy financially after having made the cuts that they made already.
Mm-hmm.
But they've definitely weathered the financial storm to date better than has Los Angeles City. So I don't think that we'll see him being particularly deferential to, because he feels like he has knowledge about both governments, how they work, how they're structured, what their revenue streams are. And I think I imagine that the same will largely be true of Kevin De Leon, who was the leader of the state Senate not that long ago.
Just one, one distinction also in terms of how the county and city get revenue that makes a big difference is that the county gets a lot of its revenue from properties and real estate taxes, which have not been hit anywhere near as hard as most of the city's revenue streams, like hotel taxes and sales taxes, even like parking meters.
Yeah.
So that, I think, has led, is part of, the county also did make cuts, which now the city is possibly going to have to make as well. To me, it's really hard to make any decisions at the city, even the state level, while you're watching and waiting to see what the federal government does. Like, you're constantly, I get the sense that people working in LA City Hall don't know any more about the status of talks at the federal government than we do doing this show, or anyone like reading the news.
Right.
It's this constant back and forth, we're really close, we've got this bipartisan agreement, and then Mitch McConnell torpedoes it or whatever. I mean, that's a difference of tens of millions of dollars, like right now for city budgets. And so do you cut a lot of city services if there's like the possibility that money is right around the corner? Can you afford to wait and dig yourself into a deeper hole when this money might not be coming at all? I just, like, I don't know what the right answer is because you're just, it just kind of feels like waiting for the higher, for the weather to change, things that you just don't really have any control over.
Yeah, it does feel like a gamble. It's certainly not to be understated the extent to which the Trump administration on its way out is continuing to wreak havoc on all parts of our federal system, that this is just a transition from one administration to the next. It is the furthest thing from unprecedented, and yet it is totally different because mm-hmm. we have 2/3 of elected Republicans in the country refusing to acknowledge that the outgoing president has lost the election, which makes it very right. difficult before we get to Inauguration Day to even have a functional federal government at all. How do you carry on negotiations about federal stimulus packages during this or in this kind of context? And having said that, you know, when we're talking about the needs that people have, what's the difference between now and 5 weeks from now when Joe Biden is inaugurated? The mm-hmm. the difference is we have one more month of people having to pay rent that they can't necessarily afford. And in terms of municipal governments, we have a lot more governments that are going to be trending towards being underwater than are already there, and the situation will just become more dire. There's an urgent need to act that can't really be met right now.
Meanwhile, at the county level, you have an elected official who was allowed to show up and has a completely different decision-making process because he, as district attorney, is allowed to make, it just has a significant amount of discretion in making decisions just on his own. Does not have to take a vote with 14 other people, can just show up and do it. And on Monday, George Gascon, new district attorney, was sworn in, and a couple hours later implemented the most transformative criminal justice reforms in Los Angeles history. Stroke of a, honestly, just by tweeting, said, "We're completely changing how we do things in the district attorney's office." The phrase, like, "he didn't have to go this hard" was like built for this moment. It was beyond,
it was beyond
stuff that he ran on in a lot of cases.
It was like, it was this real, like, I kept looking to see if it was like a joke account or something, because it was some of the thing and the people sharing, I was like, the people are getting this wrong. Yes. There's so many different people tweeting it. And then it was actually all right.
Yes. It came out in the form of a thread that begins, "40 years ago, I walked my first beat as a young police officer. Today, I was sworn in as a 43rd District Attorney of Los Angeles. I'm not the same man I was when I first put on the uniform. One of the many reasons for that is because of situations I faced as a young officer, situations and experiences that have stayed with me and that continue to shape my approach to this work. Those experiences taught me that the criminal justice system is fundamentally broken. Today, we will usher in a new era of criminal justice and transform the largest criminal justice jurisdiction in America." And let's just rattle off what he did. Completely ended cash bail. As of January 1st, there will be no bail in the county of Los Angeles, which is hugely significant because of the results of Prop 25, which did not pass, allowing the cash bail system to continue and not replacing it with the algorithm that some people considered racist. So now no algorithm and no cash bail, although we haven't heard exactly what the new system will be. He has provided a few more details on that. Also, enhancements, sentencing enhancements. We have over 100 of them in the state of California, which you can get for having a gun, your sentence is enhanced significantly. Gang enhancements, like being perceived as having gang affiliation, can add years and years to your sentence.
And by the way, but this is a system that is abused constantly.
Oh, yeah.
And this is something that we've talked about frequently. We have a number of police officers that are standing trial for making up testimony. And so, yeah, the fact that we are levying these incredibly punitive sentences on people, this bullet point here was actually one of the ones that drew the most ire from the staff within the DA's office.
Yes.
There was at least one judge, I believe, in Long Beach who was just, my understanding is not perfect, but as far as I'm aware, like the sentencing enhancements are generally requested by the prosecutors, in this case, the DA or the mm-hmm. assistant DA. There was at least one judge who was like, no, you can't stop asking for these.
Right?
Right.
I mean, yeah, we were seeing, like, people just do not know how to react to this
right.
in the among prosecutors, among judges, because yeah, all enhancements are gone. The DA's office will not be seeking them anymore, and those policies are being applied retroactively. So if yep. you got sentenced with an enhancement, you are eligible for resentencing.
That's
which
means huge.
20,000 people in state prisons are now eligible to have their sentences reduced or to be released, which, as Gascon correctly points out, will save the state of California billions of dollars. He mentions that 95% of individuals who have served 20 years or more are rated low risk to reoffend, but they're still in prison because of these enhancements. They're also changing how they're trying nonviolent crimes. And like crimes of poverty and things like that are not necessarily going to be tried as felonies or like potentially even be charged by the DA's office anymore. They're also this is the death penalty was already functionally abolished by Gavin Newsom, but George Gascon is also saying they will no longer be pursuing the death penalty, which his predecessor Jackie Lacey had pursued with vigor. Even after Gavin Newsom had said we are not executing people anymore, Jackie Lacey would still attempt to send people to death row. They're diverting low-level misdemeanors into services instead of criminalizing homelessness and poverty. Just a staggering list. Oh, and also something he did promise all through his campaign. He's reopening 4 cases of fatal officer-involved shootings. And
with potentially many more to come, mm-hmm. it sounds
yes.
like.
Right.
This is... It's so incredible, but it's unavoidable now to say after this. And the letter that you read from, which was addressed to members of the law enforcement community... It is so incredible to see the way that Gascon is approaching this job, and it puts Los Angeles in a position that I frankly would have never, ever expected that
yeah.
we would be in at the front of the pack, basically, in reforming an incredibly broken criminal justice system in this country. These are... so far reaching in their potential for changing life in Los Angeles that we are actually, I think you can realistically say, at doing as much as any other city or jurisdiction in the country at this point. And this is Los Angeles. We have more people behind bars here than anywhere else on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So just... It was a moment, at least for me, I think for many other people, of real hope in a very difficult week. This is big news, and no doubt about it.
It's huge. I posted about this that same day. It also gives me a fair amount of anxiety because, you know, it's cause for celebration, but it is not the end of anything. It is the beginning of a huge amount of additional work that will now have to take place, because we, like, especially in the state of California, we have so much precedent for this. We are really, really bad at decarceration and releasing people from institutional systems and then providing social services to help keep people off the street and get people into a better situation.
We talked about it not that long ago, right? When we interviewed, setting aside, I think you're probably referencing Prop 47, which continues to be, I mean, George Gascon was one of the authors of that, continues to be something that comes up frequently from Republicans in the state of California, that Prop 47, which allowed low-level criminal offenders to be released early from prison, spurred a huge increase in crime. I don't think that the data backs that up, but just saying what their argument is. But also, if you go back on this show, a couple weeks ago, we spoke with Ben Oreskes and Doug Smith of the LA Times, and we talked about bridge housing,
mm-hmm.
which is another sort of thing where there is where we recognize that there is a pipeline, right? There's a multiple step process from getting people who are unhoused, who are seeking housing and servicing, into better situations for them. And it's the same thing here. If we're talking about beginning for the first time this decarceral process, going back retroactively, looking at tens of thousands of cases and saying these people were given just ridiculously punitive sentences, their lives were destroyed, we need to get them out of prison. That is also a multi-step process, is also a pipeline from being locked up, from being incarcerated for a life term or for decades or what have you, into being able to successfully live and be a healthy, thriving person. You know, like, people undergo serious traumas. People undergo a lot of changes when they are put through this criminal justice system of ours. So when we're talking about that, I think you're absolutely right, Hayes, and the thread that you wrote was fantastic. Like, there needs to be additional steps. It can't just be the one step of, now you're out of prison, go fend for yourself.
Right.
You know, that won't work.
And even beyond that trauma, like, while you're incarcerated, a lot of people ended up in this system often without being housed at the time that they were arrested. We have used the jail and prison system as a substitute social safety net in California for a long time, where we say, like, okay, like, these, what's the alternative to people being on the street? We'll lock them up for whatever offense, and then they'll be, like, held, you know, it's a much more expensive, much more cruel social safety net that is for some reason politically preferable to just allow people to be free and pay for their basic needs on the outside. But when you get rid of that one government expenditure, it has to be replaced with something else on the outside to help keep people afloat, get people into better situations. And that's the only drawback, potentially, I think, of the suddenness of this announcement. Yeah. And how this is, like, I mean, it'll take a really long time for the resentencing to play out. Like, that's, it's not like the doors are just opening.
I think there's definitely time. The bigger concern for me than time is definitely going to be, we know what happens when an agency is really at odds with the top level executive decision making. And it does seem like there is, I can't really say how large a contingent this
is. Some kind of internal revolt.
Yeah, so that is worrying to me. I do think, though, that we are. Can I just say, when you were talking a moment ago, it made me think of when I used to hear people say that Men's Central Jail in LA was like the largest mental health facility in the world. I originally thought that they were making, like, some kind of off color euphemistic joke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
about, like, the composition of the prison population. And it took me a long time to realize that that was, in fact, a literal statement that was literally true. Just to add to your comment about using it as a substitute for a social safety net. So, but I do think that we have time, we have popular support, and I hope that Gascon is able to clean house to the extent necessary to get those things done.
Well, you talk about popular,
yeah, go ahead.
You talk about what we expect out of our new councils and board of supervisors, and, you know, we have this all female team coming in with the mandate of Measure J. We talked about this before, so they can back them up, talk about the removal of the sheriff.
Yep.
But then we will need, you know, that same thing happening at the city. We need it reflected, all those things you're talking about. And we are having these conversations about, you know, taking that little tiny bit of the police budget and reallocating it in the way that communities want. We didn't really talk about this, but we'll talk about it more probably next week. But, you know, where are we putting the money exactly to those types of things? I mean, it there's really no other choice here, especially if we need to, the most critical thing to do is getting people safely housed in a place that's not a pipeline, just like what you were talking about, Scott.
But in terms of community support that does exist now and did get George Gascon elected, that is not a permanent condition. And it could erode really fast if you allow the campaign, the backlash campaign that will inevitably happen, to just disseminate without being pushed back on, where people will, the John and Kens, the talk radio host of the world, will say, like, look what's happened. Look outside. Look what George Gascon did. Right. Even if it's not a result of the actions at the DA's office or the city or county, they will make that connection, and the backlash could be really scary, unfortunately. Are we not going to talk about the fashion district, like, black market operation? We got it. Maybe we do a special this week. We got to do
that.
Just for this diagram alone, I feel like.
There's just too much going on. We're not going to talk about Javier Baccaria. We got to talk about that. We had our former Congress member and state representative, Javier Becerra, now California Attorney General, was appointed to Joe Biden's cabinet as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Nobody, I didn't see him on a single list for that position. Came out of absolute nowhere. He does have a record on this issue. He was a supporter of Medicare for All in Congress. Has sued hospital networks, Sutter Health in California. Becerra is currently suing for monopoly practices that have driven up healthcare costs. So, like, there, I mean, he has, like, a decent record on going after the things that make healthcare more expensive in the United States. Still, I think, was really shocking to a lot of people.
Well, it also proved the fact, I think everybody was like, oh, Biden's just appointing people that he's really good friends with. But that clearly showed that it's not true, because he doesn't even know how to say his name.
Yeah. Are we 100% positive
he
wasn't trying to nominate somebody else?
Yeah, we're like, cross-reference this one real fast. That was very shocking. I mean, and full of shocking, other very shocking appointments this week, too. Mm-hmm. I think we've been watching to see if our mayor, Eric Garcetti, would be picked for HUD a very long time ago. His name was floated. He was not. Someone
Do you guys know when the cabinet is expected to be finalized by?
Yeah, well, sometimes they are before inauguration, but I looked back and I don't know if it's not just a Trump thing, but sometimes not all the cabinet positions are filled by the inauguration day. So with the Trump administration, some were filled not at all, I feel like many positions. Never. But it's actually not that strange for them not to be all set before January. So it might be a while. There might
I'm
be a lot
wondering
more.
If we can set up like a countdown timer for Garcetti's cabinet hopes.
Yeah, I think that's just the protests will continue until outside of his house. So
entering week four this week.
Yeah,
so, I just think it feels like they're moving pretty fast. Otherwise, they're like most of the big positions are filled. The name that we saw floated this week for Department of Transportation was Pete Buttigieg. The absolute most insulting, devastating own
Finish
of Eric
him.
Garcetti possible. The guy who Garcetti has had to watch now for 2 years be what Garcetti, I'm sure, believes just an inferior version of himself. Also a Rhodes Scholar, also speaks multiple languages, also a mayor of a city that is like Garcetti's city is 100 times bigger. Garcetti has actually managed massive transportation initiatives. Yeah. Has had to deal with the Secretary of Transportation to try and get money for his city in a way that Buttigieg can not possibly claim to have done.
He rebuilt the sidewalks in his downtown, and we cannot say the same for Mayor Eric Garcetti.
That's true.
So.
Downtown LA might be larger than South Bend. I'm not positive it's not.
And Garcetti, you know, used to laugh it off. He used to call himself the older, straighter Pete Buttigieg until people were like, please don't do that anymore. but, like, it must be horrible. And I've heard, so last week, just a week ago, I think, I said, absolutely, this guy is going to get some kind of position in the administration.
Who?
And now, I didn't
Garcetti?
Think it was Garcetti. That's what I said, book it. That was the phrase that I used.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And now I'm saying I think it is time to unbook it. I didn't think he was going to get Secretary of Transportation. I didn't think he was going to get a Senate approved position. But now I'm hearing from multiple people with like DC connections that he's not on the list anymore. that there's just too many questions around the Rick Jacobs stuff, and maybe they'll just wait until he finishes his term.
And he
we didn't talk about it, but then there's also the Ray Chan stuff, right? Like the deputy mayor, one of your deputy mayors is now going on indicted. Trial.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if we talked about this last week. Would he already get the co-chair of the inauguration Zoom ball or whatever it's going to be?
I'm not sure he had it at that point.
Or whenever. But so that almost seemed like, you know, we heard that and then the climate attaché, and then he gave a speech this week for some climate thing also. Yeah. It was Zoom also. But so now I guess he'll just get to appear as like a Zoom surrogate for Biden on these topics and then get to co-chair the inauguration. Maybe you're right, Hayes. Maybe that will be all that we'll see.
For now. They might be holding the spot for him until things like kind of die, until he gets closer to his term ending. But yeah, I don't think it's guaranteed his like the loyalty he has displayed to this man for so long. We all, and like at the state level, it's absolutely unbelievable the number of appointments that Gavin Newsom might now be able to make. We have Kamala Harris's Senate seat. We have the front runner for that seat, Alex Padilla, the current Secretary of State. That would be another appointment that Newsom would make if Padilla took that seat. You have Becerra now for Attorney General. That is another appointment that Newsom gets to make. And you have this week coming out that Dianne Feinstein is apparently experiencing some form of dementia that is not allowing her to do her job. And so if she steps down, I mean, she has 4 years left in her term. So you'd think she'll be 91 when her term ends. So you have to believe that she's not going to
make it
all the way there.
At what point do you have like a huge outcry for like a special election? I feel like if it came to Feinstein stepping down, I feel like there would be a real popular rejection of having both
one man like
appoint both senators.
Yes.
Yeah,
I texted you both this, but if what Rod Blagojevich would have done in this situation would absolutely have earned him the death penalty.
Yes. So,
the amount of graft and horse trading, like it's unprecedented, especially for a state of this size and wealth and power, that much. That much power being held in one governor's hands.
All we know, it was already decided at that French Laundry dinner, and we're just about to live out the. They knew at the time that, you know.
And Karen Bass on the Sunday shows today said she would like the job. She would like the Senate job, which people are suggesting there should be a woman of color in that seat to replace Kamala Harris, and that puts pressure. You know, Alex Padilla does not fit that description. So, I mean,
right.
It's a lot of action. There were some housing. We've gone over our time. There were some fascinating housing stories this week. One that was reported by KCRW about a motel property that was bought by the city of LA for repurposing as homeless housing. But on the way there, a bunch of different entities, in particular a crooked developer, siphoned millions of dollars out of in the process, raising the cost significantly. This property ended up getting bought by the city for $30 million, way more than its assessed value. And also in terms of overpaying for housing, there's a story that came out yesterday about these tiny homes, pallet shelters they're called, being built for people who are homeless in empty, vacant lots in the city. And each of those has been costing the city $130,000, even though they are tiny. They're sheds, essentially. These stories, like, we should talk about this stuff in more detail at some point, but these stories I don't think are quite as simple as they seem, like the per unit cost of this housing. The biggest cost, for example, in the pallet shelter story was $1.5 million to like totally renovate the property. And so that doesn't really apply to like how much it costs to put a little like a little shed up, because that cost is included. I don't know. It's just like this stuff is expensive and it's hard. I just worry about like in the eagerness to attack the city for mishandling this crisis, which we've been doing for a really long time.
Yeah,
you also get into this kind of libertarian conservative territory about like, look what they're doing with our tax money. Like, there are too many regulations. There is a huge amount of waste, but this is not easy. This shit isn't free.
Right.
I think the most telling moment, I think, was in Anna Scott's story in KCRW.
Yeah.
Was that, you know, she talked to some people who were on the original HHH oversight committee, and they all said we should have done things a different way from the beginning. And I think that is really all you have to say. Like, yes, sure. Of course, everything's really messed up now because we, at the beginning, we went down this path with a certain thing in mind. It took way too long to get done. It put way too much on developers to possibly misspend the money. Or I don't want to say, you know, yeah, I can just say that. Yeah, I don't think I'm like saying anything exactly wrong. But
yeah.
And it also put too, you know, it made it too much about not focusing on these flexible solutions. Something like Nithya has always talked about in her campaign is that we should have tried to do some of the easier things first. And of course, that also includes things like putting people into hotels, which we could have done from the very beginning. So,
right. But this was a hotel that we were buying.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm talking about more the tiny home situation. But yes, of course.
Exactly. Like
this, if this, and it's also, it's not even ready. It's not even ready, and it won't be ready till March. I mean, that was the thing too about it. It's been this whole story about that motel trying to get it ready. And they also, of course, displaced people who were living there informally.
It was
to
already low-income housing.
Yeah, yeah,
this is what I wonder about. All these,
which is really bad.
These motels being repurposed, you are often kicking people out who are already living there at very low cost and just replacing them with a similar population at enormous expense.
Yeah,
right.
And when it comes to, I mean, yeah, that KCRW story, that is unconscionable. Paying $30 million for that property,
right?
There's no excuse for that being allowed to happen. But when it comes to like, I don't think tiny homes are the best solution either. But it's very easy to get blown away by sticker shock when it's just like, yeah, this stuff just costs a ton of money. That's just like, we just have to get used to the idea that this is expensive. And like cutting off the money and being like, find a cheaper way to do this is not necessarily going to get people housed faster at the rate that it needs to happen. That's it. We're done. We'll be back next week, and maybe for a special this week because there's just like too much overflow corruption content that we have to get into. Maybe we go live again.
We could do
live in so long.
We could do two full. Oh, we have two different scandals that we could go live
full
about. So yeah,
done.
Totally.
I want to really get into. I know you have already, Scott, but really get into this Fashion District stuff because this is now like the second or third big.
Let's share notes.
Okay, great. Okay, sounds good.
Thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you, Brian Holmes, for producing the podcast. If you want to support us, become a member of the Sepulveda Pass. You can click support us on our website, which is thelapod.com.
And for pass holders, we'll have an announcement this week about a special event, a Christmas party that LA Podcast is throwing, and you will find out about that very soon. Thank you for listening. Bye.